loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we have two big stories. First, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani called on the Taliban to begin peace talks, and he offered security and other incentives to those who participate. Meanwhile, since the International Criminal Court, the ICC, began collecting material 3 months ago for a possible war crimes case involving Afghanistan, it has received 1.17 million statements from Afghans who say they were victims of war crimes. Then we look to the United States' role in Asia. Will the United States be able to reassert its domination over Asia after scrapping the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, a cornerstone of the Obama administration's pivot to Asia strategy? The Trump administration has been pursuing the so-called quadrilateral alliance of U.S., Australia, Japan, and India. Before we get to those two stories, we're going to go over some of today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, in a blow to immigrant rights and basic civil liberties, the Supreme Court has ruled 5-3 to restrict the right of immigrants held in detention centers, limiting their right to bail hearings and making it easier for authorities to detain them indefinitely for years. Next, we turn to the issue of nuclear power. The anti-nuclear group Beyond Nuclear took its fight to the Supreme Court on Monday with a rare petition asking the justices to require federal regulators to change rules that exclude nuclear power plant transmission lines from environmental review. The petition marks the first time the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's decision to allow expedited construction of a new power plant is being challenged inside the Supreme Court. Then, a debate has erupted over the effectiveness of the Trump and Clinton campaign's social media operations during the 2016 election. But how does social media advertising work, and what is its impact on democracy? Next, President Trump blasted his Attorney General Jeff Sessions on Twitter this morning, saying that Sessions' decision to simply refer a FISA investigation to the Justice Department's Inspector General was, in his words, disgraceful. Also, The Atlantic has released private messages between WikiLeaks and Roger Stone, where WikiLeaks is clearly telling Roger Stone, stop saying that you're associated with WikiLeaks since you are not. And finally, the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo is anything but democratic. We're going to talk about what's going on in the Congo with the war in the East and the role of Uganda, Rwanda, and of course, the United States. And in other headlines, Dick's Sporting Goods is no longer selling assault rifles, high-capacity magazines, or any other firearms to those under the age of 21. The announcement came out this morning amid other companies like Delta, Hertz, and other major companies removing various benefits for NRA members. CEO Edward Stack publicly tied it to the Parkland, Florida shooting, saying, quote, "We love these kids and their rallying cry, enough is enough." Trump announced today that the administration will wait on building a California border wall until there's funding for the full wall. Meanwhile, the public has shown its opposition to any border wall through protests and in polling. Martin Shkreli, better known as Pharma Bro, asked the judge in his case to sentence him to a 12-18-month sentence. Yes, that would be 25 years below the minimum guidelines. In his letter to the judge, he added, quote, "I accept the fact that I made serious mistakes, but I still believe that I am a good person with much potential." That's a quote. In 2015, Pharma Bro raised the price of anti-parasite drug Theraprim by over 5,000%. Though this behavior, of course, is, quote, legal. He's facing years in prison on defrauding investors after lying to them about the performance of his hedge funds. In a prolonged rocky period, the stock market, the S&P 500, is projected for its largest monthly drop since 2016. President Trump has continued to vacillate in taking credit for the stock market's performance when it's, of course, doing well, and distance himself from it when it's dropping. Those are today's headlines. Next up is an interview with Kathy Kelly on Afghanistan. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
John, this is a big story in Afghanistan. The Afghan government has said that it's ready for peace talks with the Taliban. It's not the first time, but talk about what you think is the significance here.
Well, I think that the Afghan government, frankly, is dealing from a position of weakness. Just in the last 4 or 5 weeks, we've seen a number of attacks against both civilians in the capital city of Kabul and Afghan soldiers elsewhere around the country. On January 27th, for example, an ambulance bomb went off in Kabul. It killed 103 people, wounded several hundred more. There was an attack on a hotel in Kabul a week earlier that killed 22 people, 14 of whom were foreigners. And I think that now that violence is such a regular thing in the capital city, Ashraf Ghani, the president of Afghanistan, has decided that it's probably better to sit across a negotiating table from the Taliban than to try to defeat them militarily. Now, what has happened in the past with peace talks is that those talks are generally sponsored by the government of Qatar. And the talks take place in the capital city of Doha. And so both sides will fly out to Doha and try to begin their negotiations. Now, these negotiations have failed in the past, but perhaps now, in part because the Qataris are really isolated and they want to try to re-enter the Middle Eastern mainstream, they've been isolated by the Saudis and by the Bahrainis, that maybe the Qataris are going to take this idea seriously and really push peace talks as well. There's nothing to be lost by either side by engaging in peace talks. And what Ashraf Ghani is proposing is, let's see here, he's calling on the Taliban to take part, and he's offering security and other incentives, including passports.
Including also the release of Taliban prisoners.
And that's probably the most important point, the release of Taliban prisoners and passports so that Taliban members can come and go from the country as they please. Right now, they can't. And the only way to get out of the country is to sort of sneak across the border to either Pakistan or to Iran, and then ask for a laissez-passer, a travel passage paper, so that they can go somewhere else. It's very difficult and it's very unsafe.
You know, the current government, the Ashraf Ghani government, is, again, calling for peace talks and offering concessions to the Taliban. Hamid Karzai, the president who came before, and who was really and obviously picked by the United States
Without
occupying
a doubt.
Force.
Yes.
He had become disillusioned with the United States because he felt the United States actually didn't want to have an end of the war. It didn't want to have a negotiation with the Taliban. It didn't intervene with Pakistan, which was largely seen as the sponsor of Pakistani's intelligence service, the directorate, ISI, as the patron for the Taliban. That instead the Americans were content with just raiding Afghan villages that actually weren't going to become decisive in terms of an outcome for the war. Where do you think America will come down on Ghani? Obviously, they got disillusioned with Karzai.
Well, I think with President Trump's statement that he's in this war to win it, I think that's really pointing us in the wrong direction. You're right, Brian, that historically, over the last 16 and a half years now, the U.S. has steadfastly opposed peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. The U.S. doesn't believe that the Afghan government will get a fair deal, will be able to negotiate a fair deal. I think that's incorrect.
And perhaps the Pentagon wants endless war because it gives a pretext for the U.S. And then the U.S. has military bases forever,
all
perhaps,
over the
in
country.
Afghanistan.
That's right.
Earlier today, John, you and I had a really fascinating discussion with Kathy Kelly. She is the co-coordinator of the Voices for Creative Nonviolence. We talked to her from Chicago, but she had just gotten back from Afghanistan once again. And I think it's important to hear her voice because people in the United States who are relying on the corporate-owned mainstream media don't actually know what's going on in Afghanistan. Let's take a listen to this amazing interview with Kathy Kelly. Kathy Kelly, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Brian and John.
I know you must be exhausted. You just got back from Afghanistan and we're anxious. And I know our audience here in the Washington, D.C. area that's going to hear this today at 5 p.m. and people who will be hearing it around the country and around the world later want to know what's actually going on in Afghanistan. After so many years of war, it starts to create a kind of insensitivity, or people become inured to what's actually happening, or they don't know because they're relying on the corporate-owned media. What did you see? What's going on? What's most noteworthy and newsworthy?
Well, you know, young people in Afghanistan that I know don't want to act as though it's just normal for there to be explosions and bombings and gun battles. Truthfully, Kabul now has become the most dangerous place in Afghanistan, and it does begin to seem kind of normal. In fact, a boxing match had been won by an Afghan team, and people went up on the rooftops and fired weapons. And immediately, my young friends all started calling one another, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" because they didn't realize that this was a response to a sporting match. So you see the tension rise up. It's a very fear-filled city. And yet, on the other hand, I was very impressed. Every day that I was there in Afghanistan, Rosemary Murrow has been offering a one-month-long permaculture course. And you know, you might think, well, that's kind of trendy, isn't it? But it's not. It's like the difference between despair and possible survival when you go to a refugee camp, for instance, and start to teach people to grow their own food and to preserve the soil and to be able to purify some of the gray water and use it in ways that could help to grow plants. I mean, people are very, very desperate. So many of the families living in refugee camps send the children to the market to pick up scraps of turnips or potatoes, and that's what they live from. So I was impressed, as I always am, to see these young people trying so, so hard to find ways to make it possible to survive in this very, very dangerous setting, and then also make that available to people they know who are even more desperate, who are living as internally displaced refugees. And there are a million more that have been forced back into Afghanistan who had tried to flee as refugees outside the country. So the situation is very desperate in terms of food insecurity, a constantly lowering water table, the possibility that now the Taliban will be controlling so many roadways and so much territory in the country that the Afghan government and the United States will start to say, well, you know, maybe we'll negotiate with the Taliban. And that, of course, it means that life could become very, very different for people living in Kabul. I think the uptick in the numbers of attacks, air attacks, is certainly causing the Taliban to respond then by waging more attacks within Kabul. And maybe the United States is saying, okay, look, we better start to negotiate pretty soon, because increasingly the Taliban is being able to show an upper hand in terms of the amount of roads and territory that it controls.
Kathy, let me ask you one follow-up question here about agriculture. There's not much arable land in Afghanistan, but even with that said, at one time Afghanistan was self-sufficient in its food production. The Taliban forced many, many farmers to convert their edible crops into poppy for the production of heroin, and they forced farmers to do that at the point of a gun. Do you see farmers transitioning back to food? Afghanistan has two growing seasons, as rough as the place is geographically. It has two growing seasons. And so farmers there can grow things like winter wheat or pomegranates or onions, but they haven't for many years. Do you think that's changing?
Well, it wouldn't change very swiftly, and certainly it's hard for people to wean themselves off of growing the poppy when the Taliban and other warlords say, look, we'll get your crop to market, we'll pay you to continue to get these seeds. But Alfred McCoy had suggested some years back that it would cost about $36 billion to clear out the irrigation systems, to replenish the flocks, and to replant the orchards in Afghanistan and in that way rehabilitate the agricultural infrastructure. Now, I want to note that even though $36 billion might sound like a huge amount, I mean, you could double it and it would still be just a fraction of what the United States spends on ground-pounding weaponry that destroys the earth. I wouldn't say it would be easy to persuade the Taliban to return the country to an agricultural infrastructure that grows products that people can eat, that can help people survive. But it would be possible. The Taliban themselves eradicated the poppy crop when they first came into power in 2001. Yeah, and then they made quite a profit off of the remaining poppy because the price shot upward. So, but I'm not recommending that any warlords dictate to the farmers what they can and can't do. But on the other hand, people are so desperate right now that it's not as though they have a lot of funding to be independent as they try to figure out how to use their land.
Kathy, you had mentioned a bit elliptically that if there were negotiations with the Taliban, or depending on the stage of the negotiations, that it could have a potential impact on the way people are living in Kabul. What did you mean?
Well, in the more remote areas of the country, grandmothers have said to me, look, these cultural practices predated the existence of the Taliban. It's true that in many of the more remote agricultural areas of Afghanistan, women, for instance, are simply not in the habit of leaving their village, some of them not in the habit of leaving their home. In Kabul, people have become a bit more cosmopolitan. You still have arranged marriages, and in a sense, that amounts to buying and selling of daughters and sisters. And, you still have a very conservative code in what is the most conservative Islamic country in the world, so that women wouldn't dream of going outside the home without being fully covered, if not with the burqa, certainly with the with a shawl, and with the with no hair showing, it tends to be the norm. But on the other hand, girls I know get up on a Saturday morning and come over to the center where I stay and borrow bicycles and go bicycling around the city, and that's been a bit of a departure. Young women and young men come together and work on 20 different teams at the Border Free Center that my young friends have set up. I'm speaking of the Afghan Peace Volunteers, and those teams do very radical projects in terms of uniting women from different ethnic backgrounds to work together to manufacture heavy blankets and then giving them out free of charge, again, to people of different ethnic backgrounds, bringing youngsters over to a street kids school, and again, always making sure that the numbers reflect the different ethnic backgrounds, Hazara, Pashto, Uzbek, Tajik. And, you know, I'm not sure that young people would be able, under the Taliban, to work together as, you know, with young boys and young girls. So, you know, freedom of movement might be challenged also. So I think that I can understand why a lot of young people look to other parts of the world and wonder, could I ever study in a university in India, or, you know, possibly get over to Turkey? They can't help but wonder what kind of future they face, even though they, in many ways they would like to help restore their country and rebuild their country.
You know, in 1978, the PDPA, one of the socialist parties, seized power in a coup. And because they were socialists and because they were looking towards the Soviet Union, this was before the Soviets came into Afghanistan in 1979, they banned the burqa and they established a separation of religion and government. They included a minimum wage. There were a lot of social reforms that, even though they were, quote, Marxist or communist, these were not communist reforms. They were the reforms of, you know, the post-Renaissance Europe, or what, you know, the idea of individual liberties and individual rights. But the CIA went to war against them because it was part of the Cold War, part of the contest with the Soviet Union. And then the thing in Kabul, which, you know, I had friends who were going back and forth to Kabul at that time. And the status of women and the condition of women and children, still conservative by Western standards, was so different. And at that time, the U.S. government supported the same Islamic forces like the Taliban or their precursors because they didn't really care about the status of women. That was,
right.
Women were just sort of whatever. It didn't matter because there was a bigger fish to fry, which was, you know, going after the Soviet Union, the Cold War. When you go back and forth, Kathy, I mean, this was a long time ago, 30 plus years ago now. Is there any vestige from that period? In other words, where there was a secular development, and it also was before the socialist parties took office. It was also during the 1970s. There was a lot of secularism still in Kabul. Or has there just been a break? Has there been like a generation break as a consequence of the what happened next with the Taliban, et cetera?
It's interesting. One of the biggest landmarks in Kabul is a large yellow building that was used for manufacturing bread, and it was a huge bread-making factory under the Soviet Union, and it's just stood empty for all these years. I think that most young people I know have a lot more familiarity with their parents' experiences of the Civil War, which tore Kabul apart and was extremely fearful. Thinking back to the time of the Soviet Union would be pretty dated, the Soviet control and before that would be pretty dated for them. I think they also have a sense that every single warlord that has entered into that country as an invader or has tried to engage in land grabs and control as indigenous Afghan warlords has never had the best interests of ordinary Afghans in mind, and they my young friends have very little expectations. I mean, I had told them about the shootings in the high school in Florida most recently, the high school shootings, and they're bewildered by that. They say, you know, well, everybody in Afghanistan carries a weapon, but people don't take those weapons into the schools and start shooting the students. But what struck me was that they could not imagine that anyone would ever listen to them. You know, they already knew about Black Lives Matter, and they can distinguish between how more middle-class, predominantly white students might get an audience in the United States, and Black students might be tear-gassed and beaten and jailed. They understand that difference, but they think that for themselves, if they were to protest and say, we don't want to be victims of regular drone attacks and drone assassinations and aerial attacks and the prolonging of the attacks within Kabul, for instance, by the Taliban and ISIS, they can't imagine that anyone would ever listen to them. And I certainly can't say, oh, yes, you know, try and have a protest and risk your lives and let's see what happens.
Kathy, we wanted to ask you, too, about the International Criminal Court. The ICC put out or made an announcement saying that they wanted to hear from people who believed they were victims of war crimes in Afghanistan. And just in 3 months, almost 1.2 million people have gotten back to the ICC saying that they were victims of war crimes. And these are across the gamut. It's they were victims of the Taliban, of ISIS, of Al-Qaeda, of the Afghan government, of the U.S.-led coalition. Tell us how this is playing in Afghanistan.
Well, it really does amaze me that number of people spoke up. You know, the reports have been compiled in the past, but haven't had much publication or bearing, it would seem, on whether or not these attacks would diminish and these abuses of human rights would diminish. So I quite honestly, I think most of my young friends learned about this through me. They hadn't seen it published in Afghan social media or Afghan television. So I can't really tell you that I know of people who are pursuing their rights, but it's very interesting that generally the ICC has been conducting their reviews and their investigations in African countries. But now, because, as you mentioned, and Afghanistan is part of the ICC process, the U.S. military and the U.S. CIA and groups that were trained and supported by the U.S. will be part of these investigations. So that's a departure. I don't think that the United States can completely ignore the proceedings as they develop. And certainly Amnesty International has already compiled a long list of human rights violations directly attributed to the United States military.
Kathy, there's been an uptick in, that's putting it kind of in a trivialized way, uptick. There's been a real escalation in the U.S. military missile deployment and usage in Afghanistan. I think it's up like 7 times compared to a year ago. Talk about that, if you and what you were seeing, what you were hearing about when you were in Afghanistan. And again, for our audience, we're talking with Kathy Kelly. She is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She's talking to us from Chicago, but she has just returned once again from Afghanistan. Go ahead.
Well, the surge in the airstrikes has been partly a result of sending three squadrons worth of these MQ-9 Reapers. Both Boeing and General Atomics have outfitted these Reaper drones, the unmanned aerial vehicles, so that they have not only 4 Hellfire missiles that they can fire, but also now GPS laser-guided 500-pound bombs. And the military is very excited to be able to move now toward a new generation of these Reaper drones. In fact, they are waiting at Fort Carson to get over to Afghanistan with what they call the Gray Eagle, this big, huge, hulking drone that has a much wider wingspan but can be used, again, with GPS laser-guided missiles to fire these Hellfires and missiles and also drop the 576-pound bombs. There's a fellow who is a U.S. Air Force colonel. He's called Stephen Joker Jones. And he said, speaking of these $65 million Reapers, that we're going to go after the enemy. We're going to find them in their cars. We're going to find them in their homes. And then he added that he prefers the Hellfire missiles. And he said that he could put a Hellfire missile right into somebody's chest, if need be. So you can see there's a sort of almost bravado excitement about getting these new weapons. And why does the United States want to spend so much money, you know, in light of the humanitarian needs? Why do we, you know, to grow things from the ground? Why do we want to fill the ground with ordnance and corpses and bombs?
Donald Trump said he told his generals he wanted to start winning. So that's Donald Trump. But what you were suggesting earlier, Kathy, we have only about a minute left. The Taliban seems to be, if anything, stronger, controlling more territory in spite of the fact that the U.S. under the rubric of NATO has been pounding away, you know, for all these years. Is that your view of the military situation? About 1 minute.
Yeah, well, I mean, Danny Sherson, a retired military person, has pointed out that the United States is going after the Uyghurs, who are Chinese Muslims, and these are people the Chinese also are attacking. But, you know, in terms of the United States making gains, they haven't at all been able to use their military might to deter the Taliban. The Taliban are in far more control than they ever have been before. So it's a hellish situation that's been created in Afghanistan, and an enormous price and cost. And then you have a generation of youngsters who, you know, wonder what kind of future is ahead for them, and so many people who have fled persecution, living rough in refugee camps. We should be, I believe, filled with sorrow and remorse and regret, and do everything possible to pay reparations.
I agree with you completely. Reparations are the minimum.
The minimum is
the minimum,
right.
Yeah. Kathy Kelly's been our guest. We've been talking to her from Chicago. She is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and she just got back from Afghanistan. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Will the United States be able to reassert its domination over Asia after scrapping the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a cornerstone of the Obama administration's pivot to Asia strategy? The Trump administration has been pursuing the so-called quadrilateral alliance of U.S., Australia, Japan, and India. We're joined from Madison, Wisconsin, by historian and author Alfred McCoy. He is the Harrington Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is also the author of a new book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. Alfred McCoy, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian.
Alfred, talk about the quadrilateral arrangement following the, Trump put the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to death, but it already had a stake through its heart, and also TTIP, and a reorientation of U.S. foreign policy in contrast with the Obama administration strategy. I had a chance to look at your book once again, and I want to encourage our audience to buy this book. It's In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power by Alfred McCoy, and it's published by Haymarket. I was looking at your book again this morning in preparation for this interview, and you, unlike almost all other analysts who are critiquing the Obama administration, make the case that Obama had a coherent outline, a coherent strategy for retaining U.S. domination, global domination, with his pivot to Asia. So let's talk about the two concepts in contrast with each other. What Obama was striving for and ultimately seemed to fail in, and what the Trump administration is pursuing now with the quadrilateral arrangement. Go ahead.
Sure. First of all, both of them are trying to cope with a radical change in global geopolitics. And we can get to that, a big change, in a while. But let's just look at the two strategies straight up. In essence, what Obama argued was that the U.S. involvement in the Middle East was a gross geopolitical miscalculation. With the rise of energy independence from fracking and Canadian tar sand oil and all the rest, North America achieved, during the Obama administration, functional energy independence. Indeed, we became energy, and we are becoming energy exporters. So, in effect, the Middle East, other than maintaining a certain rough stability, was a gross strategic miscalculation. In other words, we plunge into that region headlong, committing our military forces and trillions of dollars at a time when energy, the key factor that made the Middle Eastern significant, was changing, and the region was essentially irrelevant. It was a geopolitical turn down a dead end. What Obama proposed was a several-part strategy. One, the stage withdrawal of U.S. forces out of the Middle East, and a shift to the point where 60% of U.S. naval, air, and space resources would be arrayed along the traditional U.S. defense perimeter down the Pacific littoral, from through bilateral agreements from Japan through South Korea, the Philippines, to Australia. And thus Obama announced his famous pivot to Asia in a 2011 address to the Australian Parliament. That meant the stationing of Marines in Darwin, in Northern Territory of Australia, etc. Okay, so a major shift of forces out of the Middle East back to the Western Pacific in an attempt to contain China. And then Obama understood the threat posed by China's One Belt, One Road strategy, the investment of $1 trillion in infrastructure of roads, rails, gas, and oil pipelines across the Eurasian landmass to bring commerce and power to China. Obama understood that geopolitical threat. And so his second part of his strategy was two big, bold trade agreements he referred to, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, that together would redirect 60%, over half of world trade, from the Eurasian landmass across the Atlantic, across the Pacific to the United States, and effectively render China's elaborate infrastructure a hollow shell. The third part of Obama's strategy, not readily appreciated, was a recognition of China's economic challenge in the continent of Africa. And Obama conducted, through state visits and through a summit, an Africa summit in the White House, an aggressive courtship of African leaders, not in some imagined kind of sentimental journey back to dad and king and all that sort of stuff that everybody talked about, but in a serious geopolitical gambit to check the Chinese challenge. During the Obama administration, China's trade with Africa was already three times the United States. And by 2025, they will have invested $1 trillion in the African continent, much of it in infrastructure, redirecting African trade and resources towards China. And so that was effectively Obama's integrated three-part geopolitical strategy that combined diplomacy, economics, and military in a coherent strategy to rebuild, and this is something people didn't really appreciate, rebuild the U.S. geopolitical position in Eurasia. Because Obama understood that whether we're talking about Asia-Pacific, that's to say down the Pacific littoral, or Indo-Pacific, that's to say Japan, Australia, India, the U.S., you know, no matter how we slice it and dice it, Obama understood, because I regard him as one of those very rare American leaders who's actually a geopolitician, something of a geopolitical genius, actually, in my view, that he understood that the real challenge was the Eurasian landmass. And to understand the foundation of global geopolitics, you know, we have to go back to basics. You know, back in 1904, the man who invented geopolitics, the head of the London School of Economics, a guy named Sir Halford Mackinder, gave a lecture called The Geographical Pivot of History, in which he argued that, in fact, Europe, Asia, and Africa were not three separate continents. He said, when you look at the globe, what they are is an integrated landmass called the World Island. And he said the key aspect of history for the last 500 years has been the capacity of the European maritime powers to control the world island from the seas. And now, he said in 1904, as the Trans-Siberian Railway was gradually crawling for 5,000 miles from Moscow to Vladivostok, he said the nexus of power was shifting from the seas inland, and he who controlled the heartland of the world island would control the world. And that was Sir Halford Mackinder's prediction back in 1904. It was a bit premature. But beginning in about 2007, a century later, China began realizing that geopolitical vision with this very elaborate two-part global strategy. One, investing roughly $1 trillion in infrastructure and laying down a transcontinental grid of railroads, gas pipelines, oil pipelines that would run from the Atlantic Ocean all the way to the Pacific Ocean across the 6,000 miles of the Eurasian landmass, and for the first time integrate Europe and Asia into a single market. The second part of China's challenge, and it was very subtle, not really appreciated at the time, was about 2012. Really, they began back in 2007. They began investing in bases. The Chinese began investing $200 billion in transforming a sleepy Pakistani fishing village called Gwadar into a modern port. Last year, Pakistan announced that China naval forces would now be permanently based at Gwadar. It's only 300 miles from the mouth of the Persian Gulf. And then beginning in about 2014, China began an accelerated program of dredging for seven military bases in the Spratly Islands in the heart of the South China Sea. And the net result of this, plus their challenge to the Japanese in the East China Sea, is to kind of sever the geomilitary circles of steel that the United States has laid down around the world island, around the Eurasian landmass for the last 70 years.
Let me just interrupt you, Alfred McCoy, to just let the audience know what it is that we're talking about. We're talking with author and historian Alfred McCoy. He's the Harrington Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're talking about the Quadrilateral Alliance and the difference in strategy between President Obama and Donald Trump when it comes to maintaining U.S. Hegemony or dominance, and particularly as the U.S. confronts China. Alfred McCoy, go ahead.
Sure. First of all, via the dredging and now virtually the completion of a complex of it's really eight bases in the Paracels and Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. China, although they have not fully operationalized them, has the basis of a permanent military presence right in the heart of the South China Sea, which is basically the where $5 trillion in global commerce circulates from Europe through the South China Sea to Japan and China. The other thing that China's done is beyond building that major modern port at Gwadar in Pakistan, which they completed, and now President Xi Jinping announced a couple of years ago a China-Pakistan corridor that runs for 2,000 miles from western China. That's road, railroad, gas pipeline, and oil pipeline, a massive 2,000-mile multi-transport corridor running from western China directly to Gwadar. That gives China, if you will, a direct land link to the Arabian Sea. Last year, China opened its, what many people call its first overseas military base at Djibouti, also in the Arabian Sea. And they've just signed last year a commercial agreement at this point for a port in Sri Lanka on the southern coast of Sri Lanka, right astride the main sea lanes through the Indian Ocean at Hambantota. So when you add up Djibouti, Gwadar, Hambantota, the bases in the South China Sea, what you've got is an integrated nexus of Chinese military bases stretching around the southern rim of the Eurasian landmass. But actually, what's going on is bigger than that. People are focusing on it piecemeal. What's really happening, I think, is that, let's think about it, during the 40 years of the Cold War, the United States achieved its unprecedented power and prosperity through its dominance of the Eurasian landmass. And we had two kind of axial ends, the NATO alliance in the West, four bilateral mutual defense pacts in the East with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia. And then in between this, we laid these, what I call, circles of steel. We had three great fleets, the Sixth Fleet in the Mediterranean, the Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf, the Seventh Fleet, then in the Philippines, now in Japan, in the Western Pacific. We had U.S. air bases, and then the last layer in this, in these circles of steel, over the last decade, we built 60 drone bases stretching from Sicily to Guam, right around the Eurasian landmass. Okay, and this has been our attempt through this military strategy of containing the great land powers, China and Russia, inside the Eurasian continent, giving us the freedom of mobility and trade. And basically what we're looking at right now is that, first of all, the integration of these three continents, Europe, Africa, and Asia, into this integrated geostrategic formation that Sir Halford Mackinder envisioned 100 years ago. And second, what we're seeing is a eruption of those land powers out of these confines and a shattering of the U.S. Military controls. The Russian submarine fleet is breaching the U.S. containment line at the Arctic Circle. They're gaining an ever wider ambit of into the North Atlantic. Russia itself is pushing out of the historic confines into Ukraine, into Georgia. China, through what we've been discussing, is economically integrated the Eurasian landmass, getting ready to slice through those circles of steel that had confined it as a land power. And so what you have to think of is this sort of giant floating landmass of these three continents, and with the Arctic Sea, because of global warming, only opening up as well, all right, in which there is this now this very fluid transitional moment in geopolitics when the U.S. confinement of China and Russia inside the Eurasian landmass, that's breaking up, that's over, and these two great land powers are erupting out. And the U.S. dominion over Eurasia is ending.
Let me ask you, Alfred McCoy, then, given that, what you're describing is really a U.S. project. I mean, the 5th, the 6th, the 7th Fleet, the drone bases, all of the military base, other military bases, the bilateral military agreements in Asia, the NATO military alliance, that's a U.S.-led project. But let me just ask you about what we're talking about here. Now that the TPP and TTIP have been put to death and the Trump administration's in the saddle, there's talk about this quadrilateral security dialogue between United States, India, Japan, and Australia. Of course, India is also part of BRICS, which is, and perhaps that relationship with China is weakening under these new alignments. But do you think the quadrilateral grouping, United States, India, Japan, and Australia, is a real thing? Is it, does it replace what the U.S. lost when it lost TTIP or TPP or some of the other sort of bilateral arrangements that it had with powers or governments in Asia?
First of all, Obama's strategy was, if you will, a strategy not for restoring the U.S. to absolute global preeminence that we had back during the Cold War. It was a strategy for maximizing declining U.S. power and influence. And as such, it was extraordinarily clever because it combined military, diplomatic, and economic. The Indo-Pacific rhetoric, I think, is just that. It's pretty hollow, and it's not a very strong or stable relationship. Let's take Australia. Already, half the Australian people in polling favor a switch from the United States to China as the country's primary economic and military partner. China dominates the Australian export economy, and that relationship, although it's politically complex, is likely to continue. And over the longer term, Australia, is going to basically play the U.S. and China off against each other to advance its economic interests. To India the same way. India is emerging. It's a pretty self-referential power. It's expressing its sort of act east or look east strategy, trying to maintain its once dominant by default position in the Indian Ocean. It's up against a fairly serious Chinese challenge. So India's position on all this is changing. It's fluid. The one thing that's fairly clear is the India-China rivalry. That's likely to remain constant. And China is very closely allied, as I just said, I explained, with Pakistan. The United States has recently broken with Pakistan temporarily over the war on terror, so we're a little friendlier with India under the Trump administration, although Obama courted India pretty aggressively as well. So that's pretty fluid. And Japan is kind of at sea, if you will, because they tied themselves resolutely to the United States through the U.S.-Japan Security Pact. And what they're finding is that it essentially, it's as the U.S. global power fades, Japan anchoring itself to the United States no longer is a sufficient foreign policy, and Prime Minister Abe is now trying to maneuver to maximize Japan's influence against this Chinese challenge. So in essence, the world is changing. We're in a fluid moment of transition, and people are running around slapping labels on pretty ephemeral kinds of coalitions, thinking that they're going to recreate something as stable and as long-lasting as the U.S. geopolitical position in the Cold War. We're not there anymore. It's a fluid, changing world, and I don't think Indo-Pacific is a meaningful label that has any lasting significance.
Yeah, I hear you. Obama was making the point when he was trying to motivate TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, and TTIP, the equivalent for Europe, that if the U.S. doesn't set the rules, that other people will set the rules for the international order, including international trade. And by others, he clearly meant China. And yet there was so much political opposition against TPP and against TTIP, too, for a variety of reasons. It was done in secret. It was replacing sovereignty and the power of sovereign courts for in-secret corporate courts. It was the epitome, in a way, of neoliberal capitalist ideology and protocols and practices. And as a consequence, it broke apart. But China, it seems, is picking up the pieces and doing TPP, but without the United States. From your point of view, aside from the ethics or morality or politics, just from the point of view of geostrategic calculations, Was the end of TPP a signal blow for Obama's strategy, again, as you said, not of maintaining absolute hegemony or domination, but slowing the decline of U.S. hegemony and domination?
It was a very clever strategy because Obama recognized that in the competition for trade, which is animating that infrastructure China is building on the Eurasian landmass, that these multilateral trade pacts were pretty critical. They only control, because of the World Trade Organization, a few percentage points, but those are pretty critical percentage points on duties, giving people preferential access to markets, allowing long-term agreements to regularize trade. And he, you know, if the TPP had gone forward, it very likely would have redirected about 40% of world trade more resolutely toward the United States. And, you know, when Obama persuaded our allies, he did a very effective job in crafting a treaty that, by the way, is still going on. The other 11 powers last November in that Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting in Vietnam announced substantial progress towards the Trans-Pacific Partnership of 11 nations minus the U.S., and it's proceeding. They're going to activate it, and it's being driven by Japan, primarily, secondarily by Canada, because as Prime Minister Abe has desperately tried to explain to President Trump, he was the first person to get on the phone with President-elect Trump, he was the first leader to have a meeting with Trump, and the thing he said over and over again at those meetings is, you cannot cancel this agreement, because if you do, China has got a regional cooperation 16-nation pact that's going to replace it. And as illiberal as restrictive as the TPP might be, China's pact is even worse. The environmental protections are in TPP. There are labor protections in TPP. The Chinese pact doesn't have any of that stuff. It's cash and carry, realpolitik, commerce, with none of the protections for labor or the environment at the margins. It's worse. It's worse. And the left, you know, in Europe and the United States, which, you know, the trade unions, the environmental organizations, they campaigned against TPP and TTIP mightily, okay? And many of those on the progressive left regard the defeat of the TPP as a signal victory for democracy. In a sense, maybe it was, but geopolitically, it was a major defeat for U.S. global power, and it will be superseded by an even worse treaty.
In your book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power, you quote President Obama. We're looking at the chapter Grand Masters of the Great Game, and again, you, while many people who are critiquing and analyzing Obama assert that he was a weak leader, that he didn't have a vision, and et cetera, that you're making the argument that he was motivated by a geostrategic orientation to draw down from the Middle East, reorient towards Asia, not just militarily, but also with economic trade to compete with or stop or become an inhibition to the takeover of global trade rules and in a preeminent position by China. In your book, you quote Obama, and these are his words. If you look at how we've operated in the South China Sea, we have been able to mobilize most of Asia to isolate China in ways that have surprised China, frankly, and have very much served our interest in strengthening our alliances. Now, that's not a passive orientation. That's an aggressive orientation of someone who is playing geostrategic chess, as you put it, and you label Obama as a grand master in the geostrategic chess game. Here we have, it's a sudden and stark reversal, though. First of all, with what happened with Duterte when he came into office, the rebuff of the Obama administration, the announced reorientation towards China, that's shifted a little bit since Trump, but I don't know how much so. And certainly in other ways, the Trump administration's Make America First orientation seems to, if the Chinese were surprised by America's geostrategic moves, they must be quite happy with Trump.
I think they're delighted with Trump. China is playing a long game geopolitically. I mean, the kinds of infrastructure, the investments they're making that probably tot up to something like $2 trillion in Africa and Eurasia are essentially not even a 10-year. It's a 20 to 50-year strategy for laying down an infrastructure for a fundamental geopolitical reorientation. So China's playing a long hand. And if you look at the kind of gains that they're making with against the Trump administration, with its obsessive and understandable but otherwise obsessive focus on the nuclear situation in North Korea, China's played that brilliantly. They got the United States to, first of all, hold off on any trade sanctions. Trump thundered on the campaign trail about restraining China. Well, the U.S. trade gap with China has grown under the Trump administration. So far, there have been no serious sanctions. The second thing is that for the better part of about 6 months, the Trump administration canceled the U.S. Freedom of Navigation patrols in the South China Sea. Under Obama, major carrier attack groups led by USS Stennis used to foray through the South China Sea, sailing close to those Chinese islands in the Spratlys on so-called freedom of navigation patrols, a clear sign of U.S. determination to keep those sea lanes open. Well, for 6 months, basically from August of last year until early this year, there were no patrols, and the patrols that have come since have been by single ships, hot, low profile, just sort of sailing through, not disturbing China too much. So in effect, in two key areas, China has played the Korea crisis and gotten the United States to back off on both trade sanctions and on the challenge of the Chinese position in the South China Sea. So China's playing a long hand. America is all, during the Cold War, we played a long hand. Since then, we have not played a long hand, and China is acing the U.S. diplomatically. Our position is weakening.
We're gonna leave it right there. We've been joined from Madison, Wisconsin, by historian and author Alfred McCoy. He is the Harrington Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of a new book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. I urge everyone to get this book. It's published by Haymarket. Alfred McCoy, thank you so much. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.